Hi, this is Kirby Shibaga.
Hey, this is Nero Desai.
And along with Steven Hsu, this is Vinay, and welcome to this episode of XRC Pod. And today we're going to talk about startups, the ecosystem, funding. We're going to go all in. Why? Because we have a very special guest, Elizabeth Scallon. Elizabeth's done so much around the startup and ecosystem and just overall community space. Currently, she's at the Alexa Startup and Fund. She's running the go-to-market and the operations, previously also the head of WeWork Labs for the US West and LATAM markets. And before then, director at CoMotion Labs, which was a makerspace based out of University of Washington. Elizabeth, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much. So glad to be here.
I know I must have missed some stuff. What else did I miss?
No, I mean, I think that's it. You know, been helping startups for the last 15 years, either being inside of a startup or, you know, being part of that ecosystem, helping startups go from that idea stage to scale up. I love the really early stage aspect of that idea, you know, pre-seed, seed, getting the first funding in, you know, getting that first, you know, up to 10 employees. I've helped probably hundreds of startups within our ecosystem, from, you know, biotech to AR, VR to blockchain to, AI, and even some CPG companies that, you know, have actual inventory, right? It's like physical products that they have to sell. So had a lot of fun and just, again, excited and honored to be here today.
Yeah, we're super stoked to have you. And I know the community is as well, because it's hard not to talk about emerging technologies without talking about startups, talking about investments, and talking about all those pieces of the unknown. But before we get into that, I'm hoping you got a little bit more time to yourselves during COVID, especially with the amount of traveling you were doing. Anything interesting you learned about yourself during more of that social lockdown period?
Yeah, a random tidbit that I found out about myself is that I really enjoy doing dishes. At the end of the night, after a really long day, doing, you know, all the dishes actually is sort of meditative to me. That's funny. I didn't know that he had that. But yeah, it's actually really just like, you know, because sometimes I'll be in meetings from 8 o'clock in the morning till 8 o'clock at night. And so I don't get out to do a long walk. And that's what I prefer to do. And so kind of doing those dishes is just one way to, you know, do something with your hands and also have a sense of accomplishment before bed. It's like interesting meditative practice now for me.
For sure. I learned something about Nirav, I don't know about myself, that during this pandemic, is that his love for Bruce Springsteen, and it's extremely irritating.
Yeah, it goes pretty deep.
Hold on, you have to tell me the backstory. Is it like you went to concerts when you were a kid, and so like you just always grew up with him? Like what was the deal?
I did live on the East Coast for about 7 years, so that has an influence. But it was really, I was listening to my hometown while driving through small Texas towns when I was going to college, and it just fits so well.
That's fun. I like it. What about you, Kirby?
Oh, man. Yeah, I've learned that COVID-19 is sort of like, what do they call it when kids go to college the first year and they gain weight? I think I've gained 19 pounds. So.
Well, what's your favorite snack? Like, what do you think is like actually enticing you to put on those pounds? Like, is it like chips, cookies, ice cream?
Number one, that's chips are the impossible one for me to break. Yeah.
Okay, so what kind? Like, what is your favorite? Like, if we were going to send you like a goodie package.
Oh, man. You know, salt and vinegar is always good. Mm-hmm. Sour cream and onion. Barbecue.
Sour cream and onion, I'd do that. But not the salt and vinegar. I don't know. Like for me, that's just like no way. But cool.
I could say ketchup, but I don't know if you'd get the...
I've had ketchup chips. I don't think they're very popular here in the U.S., but they're very tasty.
It's a Canadian thing.
Yeah, we have that. I think it's a British thing too. We have that in Fiji quite a bit too. So a lot of places. For me, actually, my favorite. I don't know what I realized in general, but definitely the snacking. My snacking game was like next level. I found more of the healthier snacks. I have things from like chicken and waffle chips to just, yeah, to like keto chocolate and yeah, and everything in between. And then occasionally I'll go binge eat a couple of pies to myself, pizza.
Yeah, Vinay's got mad snacking feels. It's kind of next level.
Yeah, I'm obsessed. I'm obsessed with snacks. Yes, that's me. But
so, speaking of the food dialogue, regarding your question, Vinay, I've learned that about during the COVID lockdown, I've learned that a man can only eat so many quesadillas. There is a wow. limit, and I think I have reached that.
Wow. So I guess you've also got the COVID-19 going on then too.
Yeah, I'm exercising more, so that helps.
Good thing a lot of these video calls are kind of neck up, right? So you just have no idea. Avatars for the win. That's awesome. All right, so snacks aside, let's go back to startups and Startup 101. When we think about startups, we think about them in so many different ways. So I like to usually start off with just a common understanding. So how would you define a startup? What's your definition of a startup, Elizabeth?
A startup is someone who's challenging the status quo, who has a product or service that they are commercializing and want to have a big impact. So I used to always define a startup as someone who was like breaking a law, you know, because like, there's usually something that there's a policy or a practice that most people, you know, see as the rule of law, and that startups usually always want to go outside of that bounds. But there's a lot of great startups that are, you know, squarely inside of the law, that do not break the law, that are a startup. But it's really that experimental business model that they may not really have a full-fledged roadmap out into the market, but they're going to run some experiments to see, you know, does their solution and product really have a mass appeal where people are willing to pay for that in some form. And so I think that really is starting to become my definition of a startup.
That's great. And, you know, oftentimes when people think of startups, they're thinking of tech companies, and I that's not your opinion, definitely not the case. How would you kind of help to kind of clear the air a little bit on that kind of assumption?
Yeah, I think for me, it's startups can, you know, be CPG companies that do have high growth potential and have that velocity, right? Because like a small business, you would imagine just has a, you know, that definition really looks at businesses that have iterative value add and ability to grow. Startups usually have a higher velocity for growth that maybe they're slow to understand their product market fit, their channel market fit. And then once they do, they have that scale to impact that is just at a higher velocity than a small business. And that velocity can happen through technology. It can happen through products, through distribution. And so I think that really is that launch. Some call it venture backable, but again, venture backable and how you invest in a startup actually doesn't really take into account what makes a startup. So it's really that, you know, slow and steady, and then all of a sudden, really high velocity for impact later stage, because you can impact, you know, through scaling, through distribution, through awareness.
So essentially, you're saying go big or go home, or go big or go back to being a small business.
Exactly. And there's nothing wrong with small businesses. Yeah. They're the backbone of our economy. They make a lot of sense. They have products and services that are usually really applicable to one geography, one location, one small segment, which are fantastic, right? And we need those. But again, if you're looking for something that scales, that impacts, you know, millions or billions of people around the world, you want to be able to that in itself is a startup and not a small business. And then once you have that product market fit, channel market fit, and you're in that growth stage, then great. Now you've entered into enterprise, right? But until that point, when you have a business model that works, when you have a product and product lines that have impact, and then and then once you understand that those channels with your products, and you have all that fitting, that's when sort of that big magic unicorn moment happens.
So there's a element of risk compared to what you're describing as a standard smaller business in the community.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, I love how you kind of let me know if I get this wrong, but the difference between a small business and a startup is a startup has a higher velocity for growth. And I think that's kind of, and you know, there's also, you don't necessarily have to go for VC funding or external funding. I mean, that doesn't mean you need, first of all, that should be your only path, right, for growth is like external funding, because there's some challenges. And we'll definitely get into what does it mean for trade-off. And kind of sticking with some of the startup one-on-ones, what are the differences between an accelerator and an incubator, and what sets the good ones apart?
Yeah, so accelerator and incubator are programs that help startups, usually at the very early stage, idea stage, pre-seed, seed, you know, or market, you know, minimal viable product before you have a product out. It's interesting. There's ways that you can describe startups either by funding or by their product or by how many employees. But basically, if you look at very early stage companies, what sets them apart, like with these startup programs, is how long they work with them. So if you're an incubator, usually you're not time bound. Usually a startup will pay the incubator for their services and their guidance. And then and they may or may not have funding associated with that incubator. And they usually don't have to give up any equity to be part of that incubator. Now, an accelerator is time bound. You have a start date and you have an end date. It usually has some funding associated with it. And for that funding, you have to give up equity. So you usually don't pay them to be a part of the program through cash. You pay them through equity. But you are getting some form of capital for your company in return. Usually, accelerators have smaller cohorts. Incubators are usually more open and fluid on who comes in. Accelerators usually are bound by a theme or a topic or a vertical. Most incubators are, the majority of them are nonprofit or are from like government agencies that are trying to actually create that economic development. And so usually are have some sort of nonprofit government angle to them. Not all. I mean, there's tons of private incubators as well. Accelerators sometimes are backed by, because there's a capital element to it, usually are connected by like some sort of VC, some sort of like fund associated with that. And then what we're seeing now is a lot of merging between the two, between an incubator and accelerator, where, you know, you can have time bound but not have any funding and you still have a cohort base, but not be connected to a, you know, a fund. So, and then some incubators are doing themes, you know, around an entire theme. So there's a lot of different angles between the accelerator and incubator.
That's a great explanation.
So I've been hearing more and more these days about alternative models beyond incubator and accelerators. So Foundry is a term that comes up, the startup studio model.
Yeah.
And these are more on the enterprise side. Thoughts on is it across the board?
Yes, across the board. I mean, you look at, you know, in Seattle, where all of us are located, I mean, we have PSL and we have Madrona Venture Labs, right? So these are some of the early startup studios where what they do is they basically hire out a CEO to develop ideas internally. So, you know, a CEO will get a decent salary. And for the first year, they will work on these concepts that they've identified as trends that they can put, you know, a team around and explore. And so then they'll have a year of that, you know, internal incubation of their startup. So maybe they do 5 or 6 a year. And then at the end of that, they'll see what the progress is. And if they look good and they have good traction, we'll then spin them out and then raise external capital for that project. And we'll put more of a team around that. So they'll have kind of an internal innovation team working through this, like an enterprise may have as well, right? And how they do their innovation. So it's very much but like in the VC world. So instead of, you know, calling out for external startups to come in and work in with them, they basically are home growing their own startups to go from that idea stage out, but it's their idea. So then you have to bank on, is that group the smartest group in the world to come up with those ideas and those product lines that the world needs? And can they identify the right talent for that? Because otherwise, you know, what we see was just regular startups. Most of the regular startups are just started by people who are really annoyed at the status quo and just cannot get past that feeling of like, there has to be a better way. There has to be a new solution to this. And so that then ties that founder and that team to solve that problem. Now, then the big, you know, experiment is, can you hire someone to care about a problem that they never cared about originally to start the startup themselves? And the experiment's still going on. I don't know the answer, right? So it'll be interesting to see.
Yeah, so many layers to kind of peel back in those kind of those challenges, especially in a very kind of tech-centric starting a company model, right? You're almost trying to find a problem and solve for it with the right team versus kind of some of the things that we've seen, even some of the accelerators that I've worked with you on, where you have a group of people that are literally trying to solve clean water issues in a US-based town or city, right? And that is so personal. That passion, though, is something that you and I have talked about. When the problem is so real and it's not technology-centric, you'll find technology just being a tool, right? Instead of being the way to maybe accelerate or change your velocity. What are your thoughts around kind of organizations like that that are may not be the Silicon Valley kind of typical? Is that a trend? Should we do more of that? Or is that kind of just more of an anomaly?
Yeah, no, I mean, I think that we have innovators and entrepreneurs everywhere in the world, right? Everywhere that we see someone, you know, in dealing with some sort of hardship of some sort and dealing with, you know, the problems of the world and wanting to go ahead and find a solution and to create a better world, right? Through that solution or through that product. And so I definitely think that Silicon Valley is not the epicenter of great minds. It's just that we've never tapped into the great minds that are everywhere in the world. And so we, you know, because as we see with capital, Silicon Valley is still the reigning city for capital in the world, right? And so, like, those are the ideas that get funded. But, you know, it just brings up a really good point of how many great minds are we leaving behind because we're not funding them? And how many great solutions are we not getting to market because people are refusing to fund them? And I think that's the tragedy.
Yeah, for sure. I think I learned this from Nirav, that, you know, when he vacations, he makes sure he visits an incubator, an accelerator in the places. And I've done that. Actually, Nirav and I did a trip together once where he was out of commission because he wanted to go ride a scooter and broke multiple bones. And so while he was recovering, I walked down. They were in Medellin in Colombia, and I walked down one of the incubators that we saw that we had walked past. And they were doing blockchain to help with resource allocation between different countries because currency fluctuations. And when you see these very innovative ways, because they have abundance of resources, but because you can't depend, by the time you lock a resource down, transfer it over, currency fluctuations, there's that so much volatility, you can't build a business around it. But then to see these kind of minds at work, and I've done that now several times since, but I agree with you, there's so much innovation around the world. And I think we think that we need to be in the valley, but
I love that. I mean, Nigeria, there's a company that, that was part of that cohort that you were talking about earlier, called Shift, Power Solutions. And what was wonderful about them is they're trying to solve the inconsistencies of Nigeria power grid and through clean energy and really through distribution, of how to, how to allocate and how to store. And so creating a software system on top of a hardware system. And that, you know, you get it right there. It's applicable everywhere.
For sure.
And so I think that's what's really cool, too, is that, you know, it's not just it has to be done here and then out. It's like, no, you could solve it in Colombia, Nigeria, et cetera, and then bring all those innovations back. I think that's, you know, part of the globalization that I'm excited about. Because, yeah, with the world of having all these great minds everywhere solving really hard problems, we should be able to import those great innovations in America so that we also can have the best here.
So Elizabeth, I think is particularly unique, and I think you have a great perspective on this, is, you know, as Kirby said, it's about risk for startups, but you tend to work with startups that often work in risk-averse industries. And I'd love to get your thoughts on the difference between breaking into an industry or disrupting an industry that's ready for disruption versus industries that are, you know, kind of set in their ways and are not likely to accept technological innovation or different modes of behavior.
Yeah, I love that. a lot of industries are not ready to be disrupted, right? Because they have a political relationship with the people in power who've always done it one way. And so also changing mindsets amongst themselves is really hard. But I think that just allows for larger disruption to happen, right? As soon as you have a closed mindset, you're basically saying that you're going to have a competitor beat you in the market. And so I think that's what we're seeing with some of these old technologies or these old areas that don't have big technology infusion at a constant rate. Those are the ones that are going to be disrupted the most because they won't even be able to see what's coming. They won't even be able to identify it. They won't know how it happened to them. They will not see it. And again, it's just because of that closed mindset. And they think that the world works still in a tight power controlled way, which, you know, in some industries maybe, but I think that's where when you hit the consumer with your product and innovation and the consumer wants to adopt it, all of a sudden you can't stop a consumer from wanting what they want, regardless of what you are in an enterprise. I mean, you can go ahead and have a merger and acquisition and try to take it in if you're smart, or, you know, you're going to just have a brand new company as a competitor because, again, the mindset was not open to innovation.
Is there a model that works better for those types of industries, say incubators or accelerators or foundries or studios?
Yeah, I mean, I don't know yet, right? So the truth answer is that I think you have to run all these experiments. So, you know, what I have seen so far is that first you have to just bring the startup mindset into the enterprise. So some enterprises like to do that through an accelerator model. Some of them like to do it just through, you know, light touches of you know, like thought leadership events and stuff like that. But it's however you bring those startups into the enterprise or into that industry so that they have a voice at the table. That's what's important, be it startup studio from internally, or be it through an accelerator model where you can mentor and partner with those startups directly, or if it's just, you know, at some sort of cadence where you're engaging your executive leadership with those startups, will just help.
Yeah, the other thing I was thinking about is not just the funding aspect, like you mentioned, you know, in the Valley, they have the most funding, therefore there's a lot of ideas that get taken forward. But, you know, what we were just talking about with Nirav is the mindset and the culture. So, you know, even within the U.S., different parts of the country have different cultures and different mindset to say, hey, I can solve this. And other parts might say, that's not my job. Someone else will do it. And then, you know, maybe other countries say, I don't have any way to do this. The cool thing I see is that technology and these large cloud infrastructures that are available around the world now make it so that anybody can have an impact globally. And I'm hoping and curious what your thoughts are on education so that we build a next generation of folks that realize they can change their future. It's their future to change.
I love that. Because you're right, the tools now are getting democratized, right? So even the no-code tools are just so fascinating because it's really allowing people ability to solve, yeah, not just their problems, but other people's problems, and not just for their location or for their exact problem set, but being able to be adapted to other problem sets that are more applicable, you know, for other geographies. And I think that education, as you're saying, is just so key of how do we make these things so intuitive, right? So that, you know, we don't have to worry about the language barrier. Because I think that is, you know, like when we design, are we designing for multiple use cases and multiple demographics? And some of that just comes to what language are we writing the instructions manuals in? You know, which language are we having the demos in? And I think these are the you know, this is just top of mind for me because it's like, you know, working in Latin America, it was like, yeah, we really need to make sure that we're thinking holistically through the language and can't just default to English because it's easier for us here in the U.S., right? Really thinking multiculturally, but then with that education. So, you know, it'd be ideal if It was so intuitive. No one needed any education. We just, you know, threw together, you know, the tools at them, and then they could go build. But I think that there is that mindset that we have to help cement. And I think that is part of all of our jobs as a technologist, as innovators, to say, okay, what are those programs that we're going to support? And there's tons of great programs out there. Most of the universities in America do have branches out that are working around the world with other parts to educate, right, the next generation. But I mean, I think that that is something that we have to think about, and just keep on enforcing, right? That, you know, education and technology education is key on top of, you know, all the other disciplines. Because I think as we start exploring, you know, we're seeing art a lot in VR, right? So I'm just going to pick on VR industry as one. But you don't just need a technology degree or education for art and VR. You really need art education, right? And so it's like, and I hate this whole thing that I see sometimes, that people are just like, oh, we only need, you know, STEM education around the world. It's like, no, we still need humanities. We still need art. We still need all these other aspects so that these experiences actually connect and resonate with people. You can't just have some, you know, some code and think that you're good. It's like, it has to actually speak to the human spirit. And so I think that's where I really want to keep seeing that balance in the education. And some people call that STEAM, right? Science, technology, engineering, art, and mathematics. But you know, it's just we need to see all the disciplines. And I know that's not a great answer, because it's like, well, yeah, we need to do it all. And you know, that's how we used to do our education, right? Back in Socrates' time, and then, you know, in the Middle Ages, no one was ever just one, was never just a scientist. They were always a scientist and an artist and a musician and all these different disciplines. We just stopped, you know, I don't know, maybe about 200 years ago, and started going really deep in one discipline. And we thought that was good. And it's like, well, no, we're done with that. We have to go back up and really go horizontal amongst all these disciplines, and take those moments from each other so that we can then build something that's more holistic, rather than just, you know, hyper-focused only on technology or one discipline. It's, the world is way too much more multidisciplinary for us to think in that one dimension.
And those are great points, and I think it's why we are in XR. XR is one of the few technologies that was built for and around people, right? The human element. You know, when we transitioned from computers to mobile devices, we didn't necessarily do things better. We did more of those things, right? More microtransactional. And over time, you're doing the dishes is a great example of that. We need to make that mind-body connection. We need to be able to be creative. There's so many more aspects of our brain that we need to be able to use. And really, XR is that technology. I think that's really where this passion comes from. But also, it's a challenging place, because hardware, for example, if you're an XR hardware startup, you're investing in an unknown industry or a growing and emerging industry with a high-risk product, and that can be a challenge. But I did want to kind of tap your mind a little bit on the non-technical co-founder, right? And I think this is why these are so important. I had a very disheartening conversation not too long ago during a mentorship session, where a non-technical co-founder was wondering the next phase of their company, if they should actually step away and have another technical founder could step in. And I asked them, are you over-indexing on the non-technical side? She goes, I'm the only non-technical person here. And I'm like, wait a minute, like you're the voice of the customer, right? You are that passion point, and it's so important. You're also thinking things abstractly from an end perspective, right? How would you, you know, really give advice to that non-technical co-founder or those founders that are also looking for maybe who's that other leadership role or non-technical person?
Yeah, I love that. I mean, you know, my past experience, I was working at the University of Washington. We saw some amazing professors come up with, you know, earth-shattering, cool innovations that would really help humanity. And what was great is that they were professors. They were really good. They're disciplined. Sometimes they just needed that business partner to understand business models, financials, operations, how do you run teams? How do you talk to investors? How do you talk to customers? How do you create that community and that engagement, that, you know, and what is even the story that we tell through that? So I think that there's so much more to startups than just the product itself as a means to the end. That's just one small sliver, of what you do. It's really about what is the community that you're building? What is that vision of the world that you want to solve? And what was it that really bothered you about the status quo that you had to go do this? You know, we have just such a limited time on Earth. And if you're going to go and spend your waking hours and your work hours doing this thing, then it better be impactful and it better be big. And startup founders always are just obsessed with this problem and maybe not necessarily their solution, right? And that's what makes those like really good co-founders great, because they will, you know, the non-technical ones, because they usually are more obsessed with a problem than they are with the product. And so they can think bigger and they can get out of like, well, this, you know, I just need to add this feature. It's like, well, maybe we don't need that feature. Maybe none of our customers care about that feature. It's cool for you. Cool, do that on the side. But like, we need to hit this roadmap and this roadmap and this product, you know, for the customer to really get what they need out of it, so we can actually solve mm-hmm. that real problem that we all set out to solve sure. originally.
Yeah, I mean, excellent. And Nirav, I know you're actually running a startup currently, especially, you know, pivoting from or moving away from a very large corporate structure. But what are your thoughts on that?
Well, so Elizabeth, I think you bring up a good point, and Vinay's gonna love this because this now comes the Springsteen quote.
Oh my God.
You know, I think the founder mindset and the motivation, and I think you're getting at this, but I think Springsteen articulates this really well, is that it's hard to tell my courage from my desperation. I'm desperate to change the way innovation and corporations take place. It's horribly inefficient. But, you know, you have to question yourself, is it courage or is it desperation, right? What is the motivation? And I think, and the reason I bring this up is because as you're describing ideas reaching outside your box, I kind of feel when I'm entering startups, it's often the motivation is desperation. It's there leads to kind of a feature, pride in a feature, where when it's courage, you're actually going out and talking to the existing structures that be and how do we convert them over. Right. So whether it's outward focusing mm-hmm. or inside focusing, but it's really hard to tell.
Yeah. I mean, just real quick.
First,
I mean,
react to that Springsteen quote, though. I think that we can't just let that slide.
Yeah. Well, I was going to say Janis Joplin, you know, freedom is just another word for nothing, for nothing left loose. Right. And I think that's actually what it comes down to, is that there's true freedom and innovation and opening up your mind when you realize that there's nothing left to lose because the status quo is just so horrible. And then it's like, it's complete freedom to operate, freedom to go and create something new. And you have to have that complete destruction of the status quo in your mind of like, I don't need that. I can walk away from it. And that like, there has to be something else. And as soon as that realization hits, it's immediate freedom. To think of the world bigger than it, you know, than what you've normally have thought. And so it allows for those new ideas. And as soon as those new ideas hit, you can never not have them. And so then all of a sudden you're implanted with this, you know, with this freedom to do something. So
it's great counter. Thank you for this. We need that.
I thought you were going to go with, oh Lord, won't you buy me a Mercedes Benz? But, you know.
You know, maybe that's the difference between Silicon Valley, right, and the rest of the world, right, is that, like, some people get motivated because they think that they're going to go hit it big. I mean, I guess all the founders that I know, that's never been their motivation. I'm going to go buy Mercedes-Benz, but I think that there might be some startups out there, right, yeah. Founders who think that, you know, I'm going to go do this. This is, you know, I'm going to go to, you know, X university. I'm going to get this degree. I'm going to go then or drop out because that's cool. And then I'm going to go and get, you know, this VC's money. And then I'm going to go get a Mercedes-Benz. And I think those ones are the ones that you see just like, you know, have $1 billion and then crash within 6 months, right? Those aren't the ones that truly transform our world.
Yeah, well, I think there's much easier ways to make money than starting a startup, right? And I think anybody that's been in this space, worked with it, you kind of realize that. We spoke a lot about startups, the founders' responsibilities, but what about VCs? How has the VC trend been? Has it been impacted more long-term by COVID? What are your thoughts around that?
The trend I'm seeing right now is that VCs are not requiring startups to have face-to-face conversations when they invest, which is huge, because, you know, before the theory was is that a startup had to be around geographically around that VC so they could go and visit them and have check-ins with them and all this different aspect. And now we're seeing report after report that VCs are saying, you know, hey, we're going to work from home. We're going to give up our office and we're open to deal flow around. Now, some VCs are saying, hey, I still want to go and fly to you and take a walk with you and get to, you know, see you face to face before I invest. But I think that's more going to be, hey, I'm willing to drop in for one moment and then drop out, but I'm now going to be open to deals that are in other geographies, which then also may change the price of the deals. It's much cheaper to run a startup out of, and I'm just going to pick a place, Arizona, than it is, let's say, out of Silicon Valley, San Francisco, just based on house prices.
And, so, and perspective too, right? I mean, it's not just a cost thing. There's to your point earlier, you're just more well-rounded, more representative, right?
Exactly. And so, you know, and then I'm also seeing with the startup teams, not everyone's going to be in the same city either. You know, I'm seeing founders, you know, from Atlanta hanging out with Seattle, New York, you know, in Texas. So it's also, you know, as we see these teams become dispersed wherever the best products are or the best talent is, you know, I think VCs will also take that approach as well, where even amongst their own team, you know, they won't have to have their own partners and group in the same city. They can also open up their perspective and start seeing teams that are hopefully more representative of the population as well.
Yeah, so maybe we're going to talk about this more too, about different types of funding. But do you see something similar with like angel investing, or is that still kind of more localized?
Well, right now we're seeing some like really great platforms like AngelList be able to help people identify the startups in other locations. We're seeing angels partner with pre-seed or seed VC firms on deal flow. So I'm starting to see that opening up as well. Now, as far as angel groups, they usually still have a thesis about a location. So I have not seen people change their thesis statements. I have not seen angel groups change their thesis statements in COVID, but that this is still early on. So it could, that might be one thing that we see is the more verticalization of angel groups. You know, we really care about XR, and so therefore we don't care about like where you're doing XR. But most angel groups are about giving back to a community. They want to see their money having impact within a certain, you know, within their hometown. And so that's usually why you see it. And it's usually broad. They usually don't coalesce on a vertical. It's, you know, all early stage companies, you know, at that pre-seed that maybe have a little bit of traction. And that's usually, you know, when you boil it down, their thesis, it's usually about that. Like this place for early stage companies that have a little traction.
I was gonna say, then are you then saying that especially in the XR space, if you're an XR startup, don't call yourself a VR and AR startup versus kind of the problem you're trying to solve for? Is that kind of limiting in terms of trying to attain funding and being able to kind of more align to these various investment portfolios and structures?
So for an XR company, no, I think for the company perspective, so you still call yourself whatever you need to for the different audiences. I just imagine that if you're going to go and look for angel funding, still look in your backyard. Call up, you know, the angels that are around you and let them know what you're working on and what you're doing for those early stage, that early stage funding. But then, you know, and you usually will want to lead with what you're trying to solve, because that's what's going to pull individuals into you wanting to invest in you as well, right? And what traction you have, and what is your thought process of how to solve that? And XR is one of the tools that you'll be using to solve that. But yeah, I mean, when you're early stage, it's all about, hey, this is the vision and this is, you know, what we're trying to solve. You know, I am the person to do that because X, Y, and Z, and this is my philosophy on why I think I can get there and the products I'm going to use to be able to do that. So it's very much more vision statements and compelling problems that need to be solved, you know, with a little bit of traction. And each field has different definition of what that traction is.
Mm-hmm. Are there other sources of funding that are not obvious? You know, you kind of know the traditional routes of both VCs, angel, et cetera. Are there some other things you find that works that may not be so obvious to companies or co-founders and startups.
Yeah, and this is one Nirav will love as well, is just SBIRs, right? Government funding. This is the best source of funding you can possibly get because it's non-dilutive. You don't ever have to pay it back. And there's grants. So the government will put out an SBIR, Small Business Research Innovation Grant, that you can apply for each different department. And that could be for the NIH, the DOD, so each division, you know, NSF, will all have their own process and will ask for applicants. Now, a problem is that it has to be aligned with one of those government initiatives and what they're trying to solve. And so there is, you know, sort of some alignment you have to have for government interest. But if you get those, there's multiple phases. And if you get through the first phase, there's a high chance that you may be able to pass to the second phase. And the first phase is around $100,000 to $200,000. Second phase is anywhere up to, you know, $1.5 to $3 million. And then, you know, phase three can be a lot more than that, depending on what the product is, or project is. And so that is a fantastic way. And then also crowdfunding is another source. A lot of people are doing like loans. I'm not a big fan of loans because early stage founders usually don't have any assets to put up. And I don't want them to put up their house and their entire livelihood for a loan for a startup. I just think, you know, there's other ways to do this where you don't risk you and your family's livelihood for taking a chance to solve this big societal problem. I just have a moral problem with that philosophy. And I just think that we should have other modes to do this.
No, and on the government side, you know, even beyond SBIR, there's also the government's now playing around with other transactional authorities and other ways to work with startups and traditional startups, not small businesses. So there's a whole slew of other opportunities there. Elizabeth, what do you feel about challenges in terms of as a funding mechanism for a startup? I know that's becoming a lot more popular. Industry and government challenges.
Oh, like they put up a challenge and then as you solve it, you get some funding for it. Right.
Yep.
I think they're great. I mean, I have seen people because what it does is it gets you closer to that customer as a potential customer for yourself. Right. So as they're putting up these challenges, it's saying, hey, they're giving you a bird's eye view into what they're thinking, what they want in the next couple of years, and they want to get to know people who are interested in solving that. So building up those relationships, even if you don't get initial funding from them, will pay off in the long term because those people aren't going to all of a sudden stop thinking about that. They still will have that problem. Even if they picked somebody else to go solve it, you know, you're egotistical enough as a founder that you know that they're not going to solve it right. And it's up to you to go solve it. And so therefore, great. They're going to go figure out why that person failed and why that's not a good solution, why yours is the best. So you just keep them engaged and keep them updated of what you're doing. And that relationship eventually, I think, will pay off for you in one way or another, maybe directly or indirectly, because maybe they'll find out another opportunity that they then refer you for.
Excellent. I think there's so many questions and ways we can continue to do this for at least another hour. But I wanted to kind of save our listeners some time, but also maybe do some lightning round questions and really just pick your brain real quick. What's top of mind? You cool with that?
Yeah, sounds great.
All right. Excellent. Okay. So what are some things that sets apart those startups that are successful and those that just don't really meet their potential, even though the idea is good?
One big difference is network. Does that founder have a network to get the resources that they need to progress? Some great founders that are just fantastic will never get the funding that they need to succeed. And so that's a huge gap, a huge thing that we need to solve as a society. We are losing the best solutions because they're not actually getting funding because they don't have the network and the funding sources to be able to develop their ideas into commercial product. So that's one. So, you know, people who have the network, they're good. But two, it's also this mindset of, you know, are they open to listening to the customer? Not everyone is customer obsessed. And you can tell the difference of people who aren't, who are saying, no, I just made this product great just as it is not going to have that success where they're listening to their customers, adapting, you know, the learnings that they're having and then iterating on those. And then also people who can work well with teams and collaborate. When you're really early stage, you have to collaborate with everybody in your company. A lot of people, you know, just have a problem knowing how to lead and how to collaborate with each other. So I think those are also some of the big pitfalls.
Yeah. What about diversity? What does diversity mean to you, both from a company structure as well as a VC perspective in investing?
So diversity to me is people that are usually not represented around on the table. And, you know, and so what we see with that is underrepresented minorities, you know, by race, by gender, by sexual orientation, by veteran status, by mental ability, by physical ability. And we can, you know, keep going on, but it's really right now, a lot of innovation is only allowed by a very few amount of people. And what we're seeing when you're looking at PitchBook and all these other groups of where money goes to, it's usually all white male teams. And that, to me, you know, is a problem because we're not getting all of the minds and all the backgrounds, perspectives that were needed to solve these problems because not all, you know, they're just problems that we're missing. And solutions around the table for innovation that we need. So I think that is, you know, a really big call because, you know, the majority minority, right, will be the majority in 10, 15 years, right, is what they're saying. And so how are we not going to actually be solving relevant problems for the customer base when the customer base is changing? And so, again, just great business. There's been tons of studies that show that once you have diversity around the table that, you know, you'll make more money, you know, you spend money better. You know, the products have more of an impact. I mean, there's lots and lots of different studies. And so I know, of course, your readers know most of them. But again, it's just good sound business, right, to have diverse minds around the table. And I think for VCs, they're struggling right now, right? And so we're seeing a lot of VCs create specific funds geared towards diverse founders. And I think that we're going to start seeing a lot more of just people realizing that, you know, a team that doesn't have diversity around the table should just not be invested, right? Because they're missing out on customer understanding.
Yeah, good point on the founders. And I think I'll add, you know, my ethnic group in there as well. Homogeneous group is a homogeneous group. Even you can have, like, you know, an East Asian group, it's still homogenous, right? And I think we've spoken about this before, but you also feel there is a competitive advantage to being diverse. Would you be able to elaborate that on a little bit?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think that you know, when you're diverse, you've dealt with adversity and you deal with on a daily basis and it pop up in different ways. You know, I'm a lesbian, you know, woman in Seattle. And I mean, you know, even in a very liberal bubble, you still deal with a lot of jerks and you know, not very fun experiences. And so I think by dealing with that, you start getting a mindset where it's like, oh, yeah, I've dealt with that challenge. And you just stand up and you move forward. Right. And so it's like learning how to go through that adversity wheel, if you will, of like, oh, yeah, this is just another one of those. OK, like, you know, you start being able just to have resiliency. And then tenacity, right, that then builds upon being, you know, adapting to, you know, to the environment. And so that, I think, that resiliency, that tenacity just creates a founder that is more determined to solve an issue that they've identified, right? And again, they might, you know, be allowed to keep pivoting their product to meet that, to meet the solution that's needed. But I think that, you know, that's the founder I will always bet on because, again, dealing with those ups and downs in the startup world is very much like dealing with the ups and downs that you normally deal with in regular society.
Yeah. And also want to call out while I talked about diversity in startups and funding in the portion of our episode where we're kind of moving things quickly, definitely not doing it justice as it does warrant much more thoughtful discussion, more analysis, because it is both a challenge and an opportunity. And it's a big reason why, you know, we wanted to even do this podcast. We had talked about our access to those, because of our positions in the industry, we got a chance to talk to those that are making the biggest, best changes. We had the foresight and not just the insight. And so we wanted to use this podcast to democratize this knowledge that we have and the access to speakers and folks like yourselves. Very few people have access to, you know, like an Elizabeth Scallon, right? And we wanted to make sure to impart that wisdom to those that don't have that access. So I appreciate taking the time, and also want to acknowledge the fact that this is so much more than it's just a few minutes of speaking about it. So I appreciate that. What about, you know, we love hackathons because hackathons is diversity, right? It's also about the community. You don't have to be you have to have no particular skill set except for an interest. But, you know, as we've talked about hackathons in the past in this episode, one, we think this is a great opportunity because of the way resources are spread out and now you don't have to be there in person. Is there, though, from a business standpoint, is there an opportunity for hackathons to translate more into future companies? Is there something from your perspective of incubating this idea, maybe it's over the course of the weekend or a few weekends, where is that kind of transitional opportunity?
I love it. I love hackathons. I'm a big fan. I've been to a few, right, that are on VR, that have been on blockchain, that have been on AI. And I think what's wonderful about hackathons is that you, A, get to start knowing about a community of people who are also interested in this technology space. Then you also get to experience the tools that are in that technology space and then start creating something. And those are just the beginning seeds. You know, I don't expect hackathons to walk out with any product that can be immediately turned into a startup. But what you see are the beginning seeds of creating teams of like-minded people that want to, you know, use this technology for a certain solution. And that community building, those people getting to know each other, are just the fundamental seeds of creating new industries. And I think that, you know, plays a critical role in society because you need people just to experiment, to have fun, to play around together and do it in a way that's structured, that's time bound so that they can experience it and then, you know, go afterwards and think about it. And then again, create those initial connections that people got brought together around that then they can then, you know, explore later on into business ideas. But I've seen great people come together, get connected via hackathons and huge fan as a mechanism to galvanize a community around a subject, around a theme, and inspire people to continue developing that skill and that tool set and to keep learning about the industry.
It's awesome. And continuing that theme, community, especially the XR community, any words of advice for the XR community, whether you're a startup or even, you know, you don't necessarily have to be a startup to take advantage or benefit from this kind of wisdom, if you will.
Yeah, I mean, I think my parting advice is that there's lots of people out there that want you to succeed and that are committed to helping you. Please reach out to folks that, you know, that you think that might be able to help you. And then also always ask for, you know, more introductions from that person. Who else can they introduce you to? Business is all about relationships and about the network. Just keep building up your network. That can, you know, and it doesn't have to be, you know, 100 people within a week. That could be one person a week. That could be two people a week. Just start building up your network of people who care about startups. And that will help propel you into, you know, potential investors, potential customers, potential teammates. So just keep networking, getting connected, and the community is here to support you.
That's excellent. And for the XRC Pod community, if there's some things that we did not ask that you're like, should have asked this or you really want to know, hit us up on xrcpod.com. Find us on LinkedIn and ask us your questions. We'd love to be able to follow through. And I'll sign up Elizabeth to help kind of run out some of these questions. But I always feel a little depressed as we get to the end because these conversations are so not just insightful, but, you know, they're also just a great motivational tool, right, in terms of that. So definitely appreciate the team's time today, especially our listeners. And you can find us wherever you find your podcast or xrcpod.com. And really, like, I think what makes this so amazing is that we're at such an interesting time right now, both to learn from and to pivot for the future. And so really appreciate your wisdom and the work you've done in the community. Thanks so much, Elizabeth.
Thank you guys. Really, really appreciate being here.
Yeah.
A lot of fun.
Well, thank you. Those of you listening, thanks so much. You can find us where you find your podcast, and let's continue to build together. Thank you.